This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, I'd like to point out a recent study that couldn't make a better case for an overhaul of our nation's healthcare system. The study, led by a team of researchers at Columbia University, looked at health spending, behavioral health risk factors like obesity and smoking, and a 15-year survival rate for men and women ages 45 to 65 in both the United States and 12 other developed countries. What they found was that not only did the survival rates for American men and women in that age group fall over the past 30 years compared to these other countries, but that poor healthcare was most likely to blame, not the usual obesity or traffic accidents or high murder rates that we would normally associate as culprits for high mortality rates.
Well, it is astonishing, Mark. And if you think about it, our country, which spends twice as much on healthcare compared with other developed nations, has poor healthcare to blame for decreased life expectancy. I'm not sure there isn't more here that we'll find beneath the surface of the research. One positive I will mention from the study, though, is that the United States had faster declines in smoking between 1975 and 2005 than almost all of the other countries. And you know as well as I from traveling in other countries, it is astonishing how much people are smoking in cities across the world.
That is true. And I hope we can say the same about obesity rates someday soon. And this study couldn't provide more evidence for health reform to lead us in a better direction.
Well, let's switch topics for now and introduce today's guest. We're going to delve into a subject that's being talked more and more about in healthcare. It's a subject that many of us, even in healthcare, should be better educated about. Dr. Diane Meyer is a palliative care expert. She directs the Center to Advance Palliative Care and the Palliative Care Institute at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, and we're happy she can join us today.
But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you'd like to hang on to every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. You can become a fan on Facebook and also follow us on Twitter.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Meyer, let's check with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The Department of Health announced a brand new investment in community health centers under the Affordable Care Act. More than $727 million in grant funds went to community health centers across the country to upgrade and expand their facilities. HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said community health centers serve as a lifeline for many Americans.
This is a critical piece of healthcare delivery. It is about people having a doctor and a nurse and practitioners who they can go to, connected to their neighborhood.
The new funds will allow community health centers to serve an additional 745,000 patients, as well as provide much-needed employment opportunities in both rural and urban underserved communities. The new grant money builds on the $2 billion investment in community health centers in the Recovery Act. HHS is looking out for workers who may lose coverage from their employers. Many companies say they may choose to drop employee health insurance benefits because of new rules, which they believe will raise their costs significantly. HHS has granted waivers to 29 companies, including McDonald's, which made headlines when the chain announced that regulations could force it to strip workers of existing coverage. The waivers on the new rules phase out annual limits on coverage for limited benefit plans. It's flu season, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued the nation's annual flu guidelines. Howard Koh, Assistant Secretary for Health at HHS, says the new universal recommendation is based on lessons learned from last year.
The major message this year is this new universal recommendation that we're promoting. And last year, we learned that everybody's at risk, that everybody is vulnerable. So a new recommendation that's very important for this season is that everybody 6 months and older should get the flu shot, should get it as soon as it's available in your community.
The agency said it's especially important that pregnant women, young children, healthcare workers, parents of infants, and people with chronic conditions get vaccinated. A Michigan judge became the first to rule that the healthcare law is constitutional. A Christian legal center based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, filed the lawsuit against the healthcare legislation. It's just one of dozens of lawsuits being brought nationally in opposition to the healthcare law. In a more high-profile lawsuit that involves 20 states, a Florida judge is expected to rule later this week on whether the multi-state suit against the healthcare overhaul can proceed. Another case filed by the state attorney general in Virginia is scheduled for a hearing on October 18th. All cases involve the question of whether the Constitution gives Congress the authority to require that every American citizen carry health insurance. This week on Conversations, we're discussing palliative care, which involves improving the quality of life for patients and families facing serious illness. Most hospitals have a palliative care program available, but it's rare that a patient could find this type of care in the hustle and bustle of an emergency room. Dr. Tammy Quest, a palliative and emergency medicine doctor at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, wants that to change.
If you look at the statistics for hospice and end-of-life care in this country, about 2.4 million people die each year, and just under a million people a year get hospice care. All the other people that do not get hospice care and do not achieve a home death or a non-institutional death often are the patients that we see in the emergency departments.
Quest, who is also the director of the Center for Palliative Care at Emory University, says the ER serves as an entry point for many people with serious acute and chronic life-threatening conditions.
Emergency clinicians will be required to deal with the physical, spiritual, psychological, and social aspects of care as it interfaces in the emergency setting.
While the collaboration between emergency medicine and palliative care remains rare, it's a growing concept as both fields seek to create a more patient-centered approach to emergency care for the seriously ill or dying. So far, only a handful of hospitals around the country have implemented this kind of program, but Quest is confident others will catch on. She's currently working on a new project in conjunction with Northwestern University, where they've taken the palliative care curriculum and modified it for emergency clinicians. To date, the project has trained over 140 emergency clinicians from all over the country. These clinicians act as teachers for others, or as Quest puts it, change agents who will create new cultural norms in the emergency care system. Let's turn now to our interview with Dr. Diane Meyer, who can tell us more about palliative care.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Diane Meyer, Director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care and the Palliative Care Institute at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. Welcome, Dr. Meyer. It's been almost 40 years since the first hospice was built in the United States, and we're proud to say that it was done by Connecticut's own Florence Wald, who brought the idea from St. Christopher's in London back to the United States. But the term palliative is newer and perhaps not well understood by folks outside of healthcare. Can you first describe what palliative care means and how is it different from the original concept of hospice care?
Both excellent questions. Palliative care is a form of medical treatment that is focused on the patient and the family's quality of life. So specifically, palliative care experts pay attention to symptoms like pain or shortness of breath or depression or fatigue. We pay attention to making sure that patients and families have all the information they need to make the best decisions for themselves. So there's a big focus on communication and adequate time spent getting your questions answered and understanding what your situation is and what your choices are and the pros and cons of your choices in for you personally and for your family. And then the third component is making sure that no matter where you're getting care, whether it's you're at home, whether you're in a hospital, that all the decisions that you make are followed and honored no matter where you're getting your care so that there's real continuity. And I think the important distinction between palliative care and hospice is that hospice in the United States, thanks to Florence Wald and Dame Cicely Saunders and others, is actually now a federal Medicare benefit. There's a Medicare hospice benefit. And when policymakers wrote the law allowing Medicare to pay for hospice care, they were very concerned about cost. And in order to reduce the costs of the hospice program, they set up two very restrictive eligibility criteria for getting hospice care. The first was that a doctor had to say you were likely to be dead within 6 months if the disease followed its usual course. So it assumed that you could identify people who were likely to be dead in 6 months from people who weren't, and that was a faulty assumption. But also, it assumed that patients and families were willing to be labeled as terminally ill, willing to accept the label of dying, which for most of us is not something we're particularly interested in. And the second restriction on access to hospice is that you, the patient, actually have to agree to give up insurance coverage for treatment focused on cure or life prolongation. And I don't think it will come as any surprise to this audience that most of us want to live as long as we can, and we don't want to give up any treatments that might potentially help us to do that. So as a result, hospice has become a treatment of last resort for people in the very last weeks to months of life. In fact, the typical length of time in hospice is actually less than a month in this country, even though it's supposed to be a six-month benefit. So the problem there is that hospice has been really restricted to people who are very close to death, who are clearly actively dying or in the last few weeks of life. Unfortunately, way before that time, most patients with chronic disease or serious or advanced illness have major palliative care needs, but they're not ready for hospice. They're not dying, and they're still benefiting from treatment. So the palliative care field grew up in response to the need of people for palliative care who were not eligible for hospice because they were not yet dying, and they were not ready to give up beneficial treatment that might help prolong their life or cure them.
Well, thank you very much for clarifying that. And let me ask you, Dr. Meyer, the name of the Center to Advance Palliative Care implies there's a need to move this idea or approach to managing serious or terminal illness forward. So tell us more about this. Is it the art and the science of the care itself that needs to be advanced, or is it attitudes and responses to the idea of palliative care that you're working to advance at the center?
All of the above. The Center to Advance Palliative Care works to improve public and professional awareness and understanding of palliative care and how it is not limited to the dying or the terminally ill, but in fact is appropriate for people from the point of diagnosis of a serious illness. You may have seen some of the press in August around a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed that lung cancer patients who got palliative care along with best cancer care from the day of their diagnosis lived 3 months longer than patients who just got best cancer care and didn't get palliative care. Mm. So actually, palliative care has not only been shown to improve the quality of life for patients and families with serious illness, there are now 4 different studies showing that it also prolongs life. And so we really need to understand that it's not terminal care. It's life-prolonging care that also improves quality of life. And many people say, well, how could that be? How could care focused on quality of life actually prolong life? And I think if you step back a minute and think about it, if you're miserable, you're in pain, you're short of breath, you're not sleeping, you're not eating, you're very tense and anxious and depressed, it's easy to understand how you would die sooner mm-hmm. because you don't feel well and you can't function well. And all the normal things we do to keep ourselves well, you can't participate in because you feel too rotten. And the other reason that I think that palliative care has been shown to prolong life in a number of different settings is that it helps you avoid dangerous places like hospitals and emergency departments, where unless you really need to be there for a surgical procedure, for example, the risk of being in the hospital when you're pretty sick and your immune system is not up to its normal level is quite high, of hospital-acquired infections and other types of hazards of being in the hospital. So I think part of the reason that people live so much longer with palliative care is that palliative care teams meet patients and families' needs so they don't have to go to the hospital in the middle of the night for an emergency, because the emergency never happens.
Dr. Meyer, it will be a long time before the country forgets the image of town hall meetings during the health reform debate in which physician counseling on the end-of-life care was recast as government death panels. For many of us in healthcare, we saw the legislation as a way to recognize that the conversations and counseling that need to take place between physicians and family members when the end of life is approaching takes time. And to provide reimbursement for that time, just like we do for procedures and exams. Were you surprised by the venom of the public? And how does that shape any thoughts about future legislation in this area?
Well, I mean, first of all, those were all lies, and they were lies that were promulgated for political purposes in an attempt to strengthen one party at the expense of another. And I hope the public is aware of that, that it was pure demagoguery. And in fact, these conversations mostly need to occur long before somebody is sick enough to die, long before someone, you know, has a terminal illness. I mean, I'm a primary care doc, and I have conversations with all of my patients when I first meet them or within a few months of meeting them about who they would trust to make decisions if they were unable to make their own decisions, about kind of who they are as a person and what their goals for their remaining years on the planet might be. I mean, these are conversations that all of us should be having with our doctor, because all of us could step out of our office or our homes today and be hit by a truck. And it's impossible to predict that.
Dr. Meyer, you referenced that New England Journal of Medicine, and Dr. Atul Gawande also cited that in his New Yorker article titled Letting Go, What Should Medicine Do When It Can't Save Your Life? And it talked about, I think it was La Crosse, Wisconsin, where a community of physicians were recognized as having very low end-of-life costs for elderly patients, or elderly patients in that community had low end-of-life costs. And that success seemed to be in part due to a community-wide practice or ethic of having the conversation about end-of-life decisions while patients were healthy and well. And you've referenced that. Is this the focus we need to take to get organized medicine, community of physicians, to make this the standard in practice?
I think it should be, but again, I want you and your audience to understand that the implications of the language of using language of end of life and terminal is the suggestion that somehow these decisions involve an acceptance of death or an acceptance of an earlier death, and that is false. In fact, what the decisions that patients and family need to make are where they want to be when they're very sick, and most of us want to be at home, and what kind of support they would need to do that. In fact, as I said, these kinds of discussions and decisions actually result in a longer life, but occurring with better quality, and usually in the setting of the patient's choice, which most of the time is at home. So our language confuses us, because when we talk about end-of-life discussions or terminal care, the implication, whether conscious or not, is that these are decisions about giving up a chance at a longer life, and the opposite is true.
Dr. Meyer, the Palliative Care Institute at Mount Sinai in New York City is recognized as the model program, and I know it's one of your personal goals to spread palliative care to all hospitals in America. Have you established national best practices and evidence-based guidelines to help physicians and nurses and hospitals in the community to advance their own palliative program?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Center to Advance Palliative Care, along with other national palliative care organizations, developed something called the National Consensus Project for Quality Palliative Care. And they're a set of domains and guidelines for what constitutes high-quality palliative care. And then subsequent to that, the National Quality Forum, which is the nation's leading quality standard-setting body, and it's a public-private entity that's funded both from the private sector and by the government, adapted the National Consensus Project guidelines into a National Quality Forum-endorsed framework and preferred practices for palliative care. So there are national consensus-based quality guidelines that teams of professionals, nurses, doctors, social workers, others, can use as they are developing and trying to build a high-quality program for their community.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Diane Meyer, a palliative care expert at Mount Sinai in New York City. Dr. Meyer, we're very concerned, as you are, with the training of the next generation of healthcare professionals. Tell us a little bit about your approach to teaching and training new young health professionals in this arena. Who needs to be on the team, and are there any particularly innovative training approaches to this very sensitive area of healthcare?
So that is the most important question we have discussed in this whole conversation. If we do not train future generations of doctors, nurses, other health professionals to deliver high-quality palliative care, we shouldn't expect anything different than what we've been getting in the past. And I'm sorry to tell you that up until now, and even in the present, most medical students, nursing students, interns, residents can finish their training without any substantial or significant exposure to the field of palliative care. So I will say to your audience, do not be surprised if your physician does not know how to manage pain, if your physician does not know what to do about shortness of breath, if your physician does not know how to help you get the services and supports you need in order to be able to stay at home. Your physician has a very good excuse. He or she was not trained. So there's nothing more important than paying attention to the needs of the next generation. So what we propose and what is actually occurring at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine is that all medical students and interns and residents actually participate in palliative care consultation teams.
Dr. Meyer, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
People should be following me on Twitter because I really try to keep a pretty current stream of links to things that are going on in the field on Twitter. In addition, we have a website for the public called getpalliativecare.org. getpalliativecare.org that has links to programs in your community, and by connecting with them, you can identify things going on in your community.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Diane Meyer, Director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care and the Palliative Care Institute at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on a program that's combating obesity by helping preschoolers establish lifelong healthy diet and exercise habits. The NAPSAC program, which stands for the Nutritional and Physical Activity Self-Assessment for Childcare Programs, aims to stop obesity before it starts. Rather than focusing on changing the habits of the already overweight or obese children and teens, NAPSAC helps younger children establish the diet and the exercise routines that will enable them to maintain a healthy weight as they grow up. Central to the NAPSAC program are research findings which indicate the damaging effects of inactivity on young children's bodies and their brains. In the past decade, preschoolers have become increasingly sedentary. Now they're only active 12% of the day. And right now, about 25% of children are either overweight or obese in the preschool years. This trend is due largely to their educators' belief that classroom lessons rather than playing make children smarter. But the researchers behind NAPSAC say, not so. This model is misguided. Public health experts say studies show that kids who are physically active, who have lots of opportunities to skip and run and climb, are better readers and score better later on standardized tests. With 74% of children aged 3 to 6 in some form of non-parental care, preschools and daycare centers are crucial places to make these changes. The KNAPSAC program consists of a self-assessment conducted by the school or daycare administration, which identifies target improvement areas, including better nutrition, physical activity, and personal health and wellness for the staff. KNAPSAC supports staff, then help administrators in implementing and revising their action plans in a way that complement rather than disrupt their current curriculum. The KNAPSAC program was developed in 2000 through the CDC's North Carolina Healthy Weight Initiative. Already, it's being used in thousands of preschools and daycare centers across the country. By changing the way preschools approach children's cognitive and physical development, KNAPSAC's preventive strategy for fighting childhood obesity, for preventing childhood obesity, is helping children establish healthy diet and exercise habits for life. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.